Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host, podcast producer, and sports writer for the LSJ. To quote early century rock band Stained, it's been a while since we last convened, April 29th to be exact. But starting today, we'll be back on our regular weekly schedule, and perhaps even two times a week. We'll see how that comes out down the road. To my left, at least on my Microsoft Teams screen anyway, a man who spent the last 4 months since we last recorded turning himself into Slim Sparty, it's Freak beat writer Chris Solari. Chris, you look good, my man.
Well, thanks, but I'm worried about now we're going to have to pay royalties. I mean, you can't be just busting out songs like that without thinking about the royalty factor here.
Look, you know,
and the ear factor. I'm a little frightened.
I mean, I could have done the entire chorus, but I saved myself for three words, so it should be we should be okay royalty rise and everything else. Now, if I had done some Slim Shady and Eminem rapping on top of that, maybe we start looking at it a little bit more.
The fair use doc.
Exactly. And to my virtual right, a man who instead of slimming down participated in the summer food tournament that we did here at the State Journal, it's LSJ sports columnist Graham Couch. Graham, how are you?
I'm good. And by the way, I also played basketball last night with an intense, talented group of men in a really cool barn for 2 hours. So that's the sort of sweats I'm putting in, man.
Yeah, I played softball last night on Belle Isle, and my legs feel it today a little bit. Not quite in the shape as I was 5 years ago when I last played.
Well, I wish I could jump in here and say I did a sport myself, but I have done nothing of the sort over basically the entire summer, really. So
I will say that my last athletic memory of Phil is him rounding third base and biting it on the way home for the LSJ softball team.
That was 2018. I played the entire 2019 season, for the record. Thank you very much.
Without a fall?
To my recollection, not a fall, but as I always joke, just a lot of meek groundouts to the shortstop was basically my 2019 LSJ softball season.
You describe my entire baseball career.
Sweet. All right. Well, since it's been so long since we have gathered here, let's just kind of get into it right away. We're going to cover a couple different topics here today. We're going to talk about Imani Bates, the five-star basketball prospect who at one time was committed to MSU and then decommitted, and now he is going to Memphis. And then we'll also talk about Michigan State's athletic director search. And then we'll spend most of this podcast talking about, of course, Michigan State football. We are 8 days away from the Spartan season opener against Northwestern, so we have plenty to talk about that. But as I said, first off, let's start with Bates. Late afternoon, early evening, Bates finally committed to Memphis after what's been a lengthy recruiting process, where in April of 2020, he committed to Michigan State and then decommitted roughly a year later. And now he is going to Memphis, and classes start in Memphis this week, I believe, either this week or early next week. So it's been kind of a quick turnaround for him. Chris, this has been quite the saga. And I guess now if you guys have the inside dish, I say now is the time to spill the tea on all this bait stuff.
I don't know how much inside dish there is. I mean, listen, this is a kid who has a bright future ahead of him in basketball in one way or another. And you know, clearly there was a disconnect at some point with Michigan State, whether it be on his end, whether it be on their end, possibly on both. You know, I think a little bit of what we've seen over the course of the last year, as disruptive as it's been, and, you know, I know that Bates had some things going on behind the scenes personally that, you know, he had talked about to one media outlet. But I think a lot of the generational LeBron type comparisons have kind of wiped away a little bit as he got out and played the national scene and really showed the flaws that, you know, that any 17-year-old is going to have in his game. Most, I'd say 99.99% of 17-year-olds are going to have flaws. I mean, not everybody is LeBron. There's a reason why LeBron was such a special talent. And it's not fair to put kids in that position, but what I think is interesting is that he didn't go the G League route. To me, that was the one thing, even when he committed to Michigan State, that I had heard people saying, regardless of the rules, they obviously created that Ignite team, which really just destroyed the rules. And honestly, there probably shouldn't be a rule anyways for age. for these sports when you have 16-year-old Dominican kids coming over here and playing in small towns around America, and you say that kids who were born and raised here can't. I mean, there's something that in basketball that there's a disconnect with that, and it's good to see that that's slowly starting to erode a little bit, because these kids should be able to turn pro whenever they want if they have that ability. So, the Memphis situation, I mean, obviously he linked up with Jalen Duren, and, you know, they seem to have kind of that, going back to LeBron, they have that sort of LeBron, D-Wade, and Chris Bosh type mentality of going to Memphis. They've got – and listen, I don't think that there's any secret that when you see Penny Hardaway, Larry Brown, and Rasheed Wallace on a staff, that kids, particularly their parents who know who those guys are and as players and coaches, are gonna gravitate toward them. So I don't think there's any love lost with Michigan State. I think that was just a situation to me where it was, you know, it's time to move on and refocus our efforts. And quite honestly, you know, personally speaking, it's going to be a circus, and I'm glad we don't have to cover it, Graham.
This is reason number 342 why we shouldn't call things commitments, right? It's a pledge at one point. It's a lien. And just another person who said he was going somewhere and didn't. I don't fault high school kids from that. They're used to it. They know when they commit, it doesn't mean anything. They don't really have to follow through. And, it's one of those things. MSU got something out of this for a while. They got the notion that he had chosen them, and I think there's some value in that. I also think the ideal situation for MSU with Bates, and also he may wind up playing at MSU, and I'll say it like this. Bamani Bates is clearly an unpredictable kid, and right now, based on the NBA rules, there's 2 years before he can play at the next level. Now, he may do 2 years at Memphis. He may do 1 year at Memphis, one in the G League. He may do one at Memphis and be unhappy, and things don't go well or whatever, and then decide he'd rather play another at MSU. Who knows what this kid will do? I don't, you know. What's interesting about his recruitment with MSU is I always felt he was better suited to join the team in 2022 than now. Like, I'm not saying you don't take him. He's a unbelievable talent. But I'm not sure that they really love the mix of guys and the chemistry they have right now. And without him, you can kind of see how this team takes shape and roles for guys like Gabe Brown and Max Christie and how this all might look. And you let those guys. So I always thought it was best if he came in 2022 that you have this run this year with young guys developing who they are going to be, their identity as college basketball players, with a veteran guy like Gabe Brown having his moment, things like that. And then you insert an Amani Bates type talent into something that's a little more solidified. Whereas if he started with this group, I'm not sure it all winds up being a happy group anyway. I'm not sure all these guys would come back for a sophomore year. Not anything wrong with him. I'm just talking in too many guys, too few spots, trying to make something work. That's not to say
the Jay Nakins factor, I think, comes into play with that as well. I really do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, frankly, if you had to choose between Akins and Bates, you know, the question always is, would you rather have 1 year of Bates or multiple years of Akins or somebody like that? And to me, it's always been the 3 or 4 years of the top 30 kid who's going to be around. You just look at the history of winning in Michigan State. That said, with Bates, what makes his situation different is the possibility of 2 years. And, of course, you choose that. I also think, though, they weren't planning on him for a long time. Like, I'm not saying this isn't news, but he announced he was committed to Memphis when he was already enrolled at Memphis on the day they started classes. Like, it was – people even shouldn't have let him do that. Like, in other words, we should just – I mean, usually I'm all good with letting a kid announce his own commitment. But once he was enrolled, I mean, once it was obvious, the fact that he kept listing MSU and all that, I don't think anybody in the world thought MSU was still a possibility. Certainly MSU's coaches didn't. And so it's newsworthy because it ends a saga. It really isn't all that significant an update because nobody thought he was coming.
Yeah, like you said, Graham, once it came out that he was in the student directory, I mean, that was 2 days ago. It really should have just – he's probably just got to kind of come out and announce it right there. And people were kind of, even there was an athletic story, everyone was just kind of beating around the bush. I was like, well, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to Memphis. Yeah, well, you know what? Yes, it definitely means it's going to Memphis. And just a quick thing on the Jaden Akins point. I mean, I would probably say once Akins left Yipsey Prep during the basketball season last year, that was probably the biggest sign in retrospect that something was going to happen, and maybe this Bates Michigan State thing might not have worked out, because I don't know if that's going to, if those two were going to work out together at Michigan State after the separation there.
Well, I think there's another interesting thing that people need to keep in mind as well. And I go to my experience with hockey. How many times have we seen college hockey players in the middle of a season who are in college and maybe don't necessarily enjoy the college experience, all of a sudden uproot mid-year or even on a whim and go play major juniors in Canada? I think that's a real possibility here as well. You know, if he doesn't like being at Memphis and isn't the focal point and all of a sudden gets frustrated, he still has that G League option where he can bail and go play. And, you know, that's what hockey players have done for years. And, you know, I also think about the Brandon Cotton situation at Michigan State too. I mean, he was dissatisfied and left mid-year. So, you know, this, but again, I don't know, that's probably projecting and pushing things out there, but I'm talking possibilities that are out there. But there's also that possibility, and I wrote about this with Michigan State, there's also that possibility he could play 2 years at Memphis if he really does enjoy it, really likes playing with Duren, and you know, Penny brings in some top-level guys that he's comfortable with. There's a possibility that he could say, you know what, I want to play 2 years in college instead of even going pro. So that's the thing about it, and this has always been the question with Imani Bates is, what are his options? And he's got plenty of them.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to a new topic, and let's talk about the Michigan State Athletic Director search. Bill Beekman resigned about a month ago, I want to say, at this point. Maybe it's even longer. I don't know. We're still in the pandemic. Time is a flat circle, guys. But and the timing of that could not have been more odd as we readily embark on a new season of college sports. And now Michigan State's without athletic director as the Spartans have their first football game in a week from now. So, I mean, where are you kind of sizing up the situation at this point, Chris?
Well, you know, I wrote the story, I guess it was about a week ago now, that a couple trustees have, and maybe half the trustees, depending on who you talk to, approached Tom Izzo about filling in on an interim basis as athletic director. I mean, sports have started at Michigan State, and from what I've gathered, Bill Beekman's office has been cleaned out at 1855 Place. That's not a good place to start your school year. And, you know, and they're in the middle of searching for this. I mean, yeah, the timing was bad. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, the rumblings were there back in July, which probably would have been a little better. I think, Graham, you wrote about this. The time for this that on a normal clock would have been, you know, May after classes ended and you go into the summer so you can have a normal search. But, you know, a lot of ADs don't want to necessarily leave their current place if they are at a football school, a Power 5 football school. And then you worry about if the candidates are leaving, why are they leaving? Because, you know, there has to be a reason to that. But, you know, from what I gather, they're in the process of finalizing candidate pools, trying to get the final people put on a list and figure out who that would be and what the interest level might be. But yeah, it's not exactly an optimal timing standpoint. And, you know, but at the same point, Graham, I think it's interesting too that, you know, you go into a school year, I mean, I think I used this term before, it's kind of a rudderless ship when you don't have an athletic director in place, even in an interim capacity. I mean, Beekman can be there in title, but if his office is cleaned out, that's a visual reminder to people that we don't have a leader right now.
Yeah, no, it's not ideal. The timing wasn't ideal. All of it speaks to the fact that this was not really Beekman's choice. And really the statement initially from Stanley, the school president, said that. I'm curious about this search in a lot of ways, because to me, where they wind up is very important. Obviously, you got to get the right person in, and they've made a number of missteps in this job over the years at Michigan State, and it just sets a tone, it sets a path forward, and it's a critical time in college athletics. It's a critical time to have the right person in the job at MSU, too, and you need somebody who's strong enough to deal with, you know, everywhere you'd have a football and basketball coach, but you do have, you know, a Hall of Famer, you know, and Tom Izzo, and but I also think the search, how the search is done, is nearly as important, because you do not want acrimony early on. You don't want baked in acrimony based on people feel like, I wasn't consulted, this isn't the guy I want, this isn't somebody who's, we're on the same team. You want people to feel part of it. And, you know, that's a tricky thing when you're the president with powerful people who are going to be working for this person. Like, Izzo is more powerful than whoever the AD is, right? I mean, that's the
probably
reality.
Sam it's a Stanley weird, too.
Yeah, it's a weird structure, you know. It's so right, and that's okay. I mean, that's just the way it is. And frankly, Izzo would be, I think, a good athletic director if he only wanted to do that. That's not only what he wants to do. So I don't think it's. I don't. It is not. It's interesting that the board approached him, as you reported, because. These are two intensely full-time jobs that you cannot do both well, I don't believe.
Well, and I think it's important to clarify that I don't think that he wants this on a full-time basis either at the moment. I mean, this is totally. For an interim capacity.
Totally.
I mean, like I said, I mean, when you've got an empty office for an athletic director, that's a big, visual sign.
When they're thinking interim, they're thinking somebody to get them through the school year, so to speak, or get them through football season, you know.
Or at least from what I understand in the sources that I talked to, it was in a lot of ways to make sure they've got the right person.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether that would be – I mean, you know, that would – you know, you hire someone by September 10th, or do you hire – you know, which is the next board meeting, or do you wait, you know, until October, November, whatever it's going to be, to make sure that you've not only vetted – the candidates, but also make sure you get the people who truly are interested and can handle not just the personalities of the people involved, because I think that's important, but also the fact that you've got an athletic department that's now in the red. You got to be able to pull them out of the pandemic debt that they're in. You got to be able to raise funds for the facilities that you've put out that you're in the middle of doing a massive overhaul. You got to be able to appease the donors and people like the Matt Ishbias and Jay Farners and Bob Scandalaris of the world, who are the ones that really financially are driving the department. And do you want someone to come in with zero experience with those people, or do you want someone with some experience? Are there other candidates out there maybe that would fit? I think that's part of the reason for the interim tag for Izzo. I at least personally, I don't know, but I didn't see this being a situation where he would do it for, you know, once basketball season started. I think that's the hope, was to get someone in a little longer rather than expediting the process. And I know that the folks that I talked to said the board was frustrated with how quickly it was moving, and as well as the fact that there may not have been a good communication line.
A couple of things. One, yeah, and you're right, I think. It's also not the board's job. The board has one option. The board can fire President Stanley, or it should sit the hell down. I mean, that's what the board should do. But this is a typical Michigan State going back 40 years. That's not really what a board's going to do. Because you think about the board. Think about what the board is. The board is 8-year terms of people who get voted in based on name recognition or blind ballots, because one out of every 20 people vote know who any of these people are. So, like, the idea that being on the board makes you any sort of qualified person for anything, it drives me insane. Like, I don't get me wrong. I like some of these board members. I think there are a lot of qualified people on there. But just being voted on the board in itself does not make you any better than Joe Schmo. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. I can't tell you how many board of trustees I voted for Wayne State that I've never heard of in my life. You know, like every year. I mean, it's a ridiculous
process. It's hyper-political. I mean, a lot of those people are straight party ticket votes because of that reason.
Totally.
You know, so, I mean, you're right. But at the same point, it's also hyper-political because those people don't get on the ballot if the party doesn't want them.
Well, but back to your point more, like the right person's too many organizations do this all the time. They worry about timing of something. And, like, to me, it's so much more important. If you're looking for an AD for the next decade, if at this point the timing wasn't great, but allow yourself to have one uncomfortable October and September to get that right person, to figure out who that is. And with, like, Alan Haller, I don't know if he's the right guy, but I know this. I know he is certainly, I think, earned a look, a real look, a fair look, you know, and earn the interview and let the interview do the work and bring the other candidates in that you know, are willing to be brought in that you'd like. And again, let the interview and your research on them do the work and get the absolute right person. And you know, because there is something at any school, in Michigan State especially, where knowing the players and knowing the issues and knowing what's happening matters. And Alan Haller has a step up on that. But you can also get somebody who comes in and says, you know what, who's been really good other places, who says, you know, I've got to learn this place and I'm willing to do it and I will do it, who's got a natural charisma and an understanding of the issues and might be fantastic. You've got to let the interview process do the work. And you're right. I do think that the speed in which it was happening, the fact that Izzo and Tucker and those guys hadn't really been consulted, because, again, you don't want them to make the hire, but they ought to be in the process. So when that hire is made, they feel like they were part of it. They feel like this person is somebody who's on their team, because that if everybody's not moving in the same direction, you got big problems.
And I think you mentioned about the past 40 years, really it's been 50 years. I mean, yeah, I kind of went back and looked at ever since Biggie Munn died and had it. Well, I should say he had his stroke in 1971 and had to retire as athletic director. I mean, it's been a tumultuous ride since then. I mean, it was Bert Smith, and, you know, Bert Smith is, I believe, the only Michigan grad to helm the department. And he, along with Denny Stolz and Gus Kanakis, were fired four or five years later. You don't want a situation like that. And then, you know, Joe Kearney came in and smoothed the department out before he left. And then Doug Weaver had a long run. And then began the real tumultuous stuff with the Perlis situation, where he was elevated to athletic director and then stripped of that. And then you had, and I think this is really where the history lesson comes in. And I think a lot of people are very cognizant of, they don't want a situation like when John DiBiagio appointed Merrily Dean Baker and then left a week later, left the school as university president. That's something that, you know, right or wrong, Sam Stanley has to understand. I mean, that's the university's history, and the people in play, a lot of them lived through that.
And there's a sense too with him that he's not in this maybe for the long haul. So, and if that's, you know, I'm not saying he won't find his sea legs and he won't be here, you know, at MSU for a decade. But, like, you're right. And if I were an AD too, and I would want this as a football coach, if I'm coming in as an AD, part of my contract is, because you want to know who you're working for.
Right.
If Sam Stanley hires me and he leaves, that's two extra years on the deal that automatically rolls in, baked in. If I was Mel Tucker, when you had all that leverage, I would have said, Bill Beekman leaves and the hire is external or whatever, it's two extra years on the contract. And he had the leverage, and frankly, in February of 2020 to pull that off. Like that, if I was a coach, because what happens so much with administrators is they come in and they want their own people, or something doesn't fit. I would want some real extra extra assurance that now Tucker's in year two of six. So he's, you know, it's not like any AD who comes in is looking to make a move, right? There's no, in terms of your top two tiered programs. And I think that's the other thing that Michigan State has going for it in terms of, you know, we talk about the timeline and it not being ideal, not having that position. There are a lot of other things an AD does. You can't just say, oh, they don't have to hire a football or basketball coach, they're okay. But at least you're not in a position where you're evaluating those two programs in the near term for a change and needing to get the person in to think through that. And that I think is helpful.
Although, if, let's say, someone like Heather Like, who's at Pitt and who was at Eastern Michigan, she's a Michigan alum, let's say she's in the mix. You've got a pre-existing relationship with Pat Narduzzi at Pitt. Pat Narduzzi really wanted the job at Michigan State. Now, all of a sudden, if you're Mel Tucker, you know those things. I mean, I abide by the theory that if
Graham and I know these things and understand the ramifications. You better believe the people in those positions and in that world daily, you know, in the athletic administration and coaching world, they know and understand that as well. So now all of a sudden, if you bring in someone like a Heather Like, you've got Mel Tucker looking over his shoulder and wondering, is she going to fire me and bring in Pat Narduzzi? So, you know, there's certainly a lot of things. And I think back to the Sam Stanley situation, a lot of the same things that we talked about with the athletic director, the politics, the people and everything else, that comes into play in the president role, especially because you are daily dealing with the board and the politicians involved in this. And he didn't really have that at Stony Brook. So that, you know, that certainly, you know, and if you hadn't done your due diligence as to what that was like and hadn't done deep dive background on the history of what Michigan State is and its history with presidents and athletic directors and political parties and backbiting and all that, then, you know, you set yourself up for the turbulence.
One of the hard things with a president is there are a couple different ways to go when you're hiring a president. You can hire an academic, or you can hire somebody more with a business background. And at Stony Brook or Albion or wherever, the academic makes a ton of sense.
Yep.
You know, at a Big Ten university, though, where there are so many components and so many things, sometimes having a really strong provost would be the better way to go. And more of a business with an academic background and a business person in the presidency. And again, I'm not saying that Sam Stanley can't get the job done, and people grow into jobs. This is a big job, and he ought to be allowed to grow into it. My sense is now that he has spoken to Izzo, and he has been a little more communicative. And if it was a real hiccup, and he ought to be, look, first of all, it's his hire to make. If you're the board, you hired him, and you know, but hopefully he sort of realizes that, you know, he's got to, you know, he'd be wise to include a lot of different important people who, frankly, you'd be wise to include. It's not even just not to hurt their feelings. I mean, Tom Izzo's been through 8 athletic directors and 7 presidents at that university in 38 years. If you don't tap into that knowledge, you're a fool. Like that, you don't have to let Izzo make the hire, but I'd want to hear what he had to say. I'd want to hear what the missteps were, what people he thought really fit there, what place people he thought were good over time and what characteristics they had and all that stuff. You should want that information, and you should be strong enough at the end of the day, even if Izzo wants a certain person and you feel strongly some other way, to then make the decision yourself.
Let's move on to actual events on the field. And as I said at the beginning of the podcast, we are recording on Thursday morning. We are 8 days away from the Spartans home opener versus Northwestern. And at this point,
road opener.
Did I say home opener?
Yeah.
I meant to say season opener, but you get it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean. But and at this point, starting quarterback has not been named at this point. So I want to start with the quarterback situation. Graham, what is your sense of how the quarterback job is going to shake out by the time Friday night rolls around?
Why can't Chris be wrong on this instead of me? No, I'm kidding. It's fascinating because I have thought all along that Russo was probably the guy to beat, right? And the leading candidate, and not Russo. Sorry, did I say Russo? This is like Phil with...
Sorry, I started everything with the saying home opener, and now it's just gone to crap from here.
Why don't we just start this whole segment over?
No, let's just start.
We're good. Go ahead.
Let's start this whole segment over.
We're keeping it. Go ahead, Graham.
Keeping it? All right. So I have always thought that Thorne was the more likely guy there, the guy to beat. And I still, I guess, lean that way slightly out of just gut, out of having seen nothing or very little that suggests otherwise. I will say in that open practice on Monday, you know, they put Russo out there with the first unit to start the second half, which was the beginning of the full team periods. And he connected on a couple outstanding deep balls and looked good. That said, you know who else looked great on deep balls? Rocky Lombardi. Like, that's not the position necessarily. And who the best quarterback in that practice was often the guy who had Naylor and Reed as the receivers. Those two look like they're at a little bit of another level, and that's good news for Michigan State if those two can stay healthy. So I still lean Thorne, but I have, you know, certainly I think you know, Chris can talk to this. We've had discussions among reporters that, and there are different people feel different ways among our colleagues. And if you talk to people who, not so much even to the coaching staff, but are closer to it maybe than us, they think it's really close. There are people at times I've said, or I've talked to, that think the coaches weren't 100% sure that the job could still be won one way or another. And so I it's very possible by now they've made a decision, but I wouldn't bet either way, but if I had to pick, I'd say Thorn.
I think one thing, first of all, I agree with a lot of Graham points, but that, which frightens me. But at the same point, I think I've kind of flipped a little bit more toward Russo for this opener against Northwestern for, I think they are close. I think that what we saw on Monday and what we've seen in the little blips and glimmers of practice that we've been able to watch, they seem pretty equal. One thing that we didn't see on Monday was interceptions. And while that looked good, I mean, I think that, and I asked Mel Tucker about the ball security in particular at quarterback, because both Russo and Thorne last year and Russo historically have a penchant for throwing interceptions. And, you know, he said it could be better, you know, and so that's something to keep in mind. I mean, we didn't see any Monday, but who's throwing more interceptions in practice? Because of the hype videos, and this is the interesting thing about hype videos, because I absolutely detest them in terms of making you feel like you know exactly what you're seeing, particularly after people were saying, well, why are you showing a clip of receivers dropping balls? Well, first of all, it was the best quality clip I had plays coming towards me at practice. But secondly, that's reality. That's what practice is. You know, I mean, it's not like everybody is making these highlight catches that you see in these hype videos all the time. There are drops. There are missed assignments. If you sit and watch hype videos, you think every team's going to be a national champion. But that's one thing that we did see in the hype videos is a lot of video footage of picks being made. Tate Halleck and Michael Dahl in particular. So that tells me someone on the other end is throwing them.
You never see the quarterback.
No, you never see the quarterback. Surprisingly, they edit that out. I don't understand that. But at the same point, you know, you also understand that, you know, Michael Dowell's kind of running with the ones and Tate Halleck's running with the twos. And, you know, but we don't know. Is it Russo? Is it Thorne? Is it Kim? Is it Hamp Fay? Is it Andrew Shorefar? Is it Zach Gillespie? We don't know who's throwing the ball. But there are picks being had. And, you know, when Mel Tucker says that, you know, it could be better, you know, that's ultimately what decides it to me. And I know we've talked about this. On top of that, I think the other component is the offensive line. If you've got an offensive line that and that's another thing that we've seen in those quote unquote hype videos, is there have been breakdowns in the offensive line where both Thorne and Russo have been tag sacked. You know, and I think Atavian Brown had one in it. Again, I don't take much and put much stock in that, but little glimpses like that beyond the great play that you see on defense, there's also a breakdown on the other side that causes that. So if you're in a situation where you have to have a quarterback on the move, and, you know, when Peyton Thorne on Monday in that open practice was behind the number two offensive line, he had to get out and move a lot. When he and Russo were behind the number one offensive line, the offensive line seemed pretty solid. And I think the offensive line is pretty well set right now, although I still don't know exactly where the Samak and Matt Allen battle is at center. But, you know, if you think that you aren't going to be great on the edge and you're going to have a lot more pressure, you probably want a guy like Thorne who's got better escapability. And Russo's more of a traditional pocket passer with a little bit of footwork. So basically this is a long and short way of saying we have no idea until they make a decision, because unless they announce it, because I think I'm leaning towards Russo because you've got a conference game right away and you've got a guy with a plethora of starting experience somewhere. And the thought is, who are you going to, if you have to pull a guy, and affect confidence? Is it the older guy or the younger guy that you're going to want to do that with? I really think that the better thing to watch to me, and I've said this kind of a little ways the past few months, the Youngstown State game to me is the one where you see exactly where they're at, because, you know, they'll probably get a better chance to play multiple guys in that game. You know, you'll be able to see who starts. That's the that's the quote unquote preseason game. This is a game towards the Big Ten. And I don't know. I think after seeing how close they are, I wouldn't be shocked to see them go the more experienced route because of that reason. And then at the same point, that doesn't necessarily mean game 2, 3, and 4 are going to be the same guy.
To counter the point a little bit, the one thing I think the Northwestern game does do is it does maybe only one quarterback, but more than usual openers, it does show you exactly where you're at. Like, yeah. Northwestern is – the beauty of opening against Northwestern, and I think this is significant. Like, I hate, as a rule, I hate conference games as openers because I think it's an unnatural crescendo to the season to go from a conference game to a game that means less. Northwestern is pretty stable. Like, in their bad years and good years, their talent is still pretty middling. They've
lost a lot this year.
They're a competitive program, though. You're not going to have the Minnesota Michigan experience of last year. In other words, where you think you see one
the red herring,
and it turns out that Minnesota's just got awful, right? So, I think that Michigan State, for a team with 15 transfers and all this stuff and all these, you know, maybe 10 newcomers and big roles or whatever, I do think that game provides a real look. To your point, though, I agree with that, Chris. The idea that if there's an order of guys in terms of, you know, replacing and going in one direction or another, you give the guy transferred in, if it's even the shot, the older guy. And if you're going to pull a guy, you don't want it to be Thorne. You'd much rather, especially after he spent all this time competing for the job. If you pull Thorne after he competes for the job and it winds up being Russo's team all year, I'm not sure you get Thorne back a year from now. You know what I mean? Like, I would, you know, I don't know where Thorne's head is, but and he can't be thinking that way. He's competing for the job. So I do agree with that. But I also don't know that as a coaching staff, you can think that way. You really have to look at it like, who's the best quarterback here? And to Chris's point, who's taking care of the offense? Who's the better? Who's not throwing the interceptions?
Yeah, but in every open practice or every time we've had a glimpse into it, hasn't been Thorne who has been the first quarterback out there. It seems like that seems to be an indication of some things, right? Or not at all?
Yeah, to me, it's an indication that they know that we're there watching. So that's I think that it. I think coaches know. I mean, hell, they make the announcements. Media, you may watch periods 3, 4, and 5. Media, you must leave now. And, you know, I mean, we're wearing these, you know, instead of a scarlet letter, it's the magenta letter, I call it, because it's this sticker that lets you know, look out, that guy's a media member. So
that guy's awful. He's here to ruin you.
Yeah, they're cognizant of that, you know. So, you know, and I think that, you know, the one thing that Mel Tucker said sometime, I think, in December, it may have been before the season ended, nothing is done in his program without intent. That stuck with me quite a lot over the last few months, from the transfer portal to everything else that we've seen in terms of hype videos, in terms of graphic releases, whatever you want to – a lot of things that they've done has been done with intent, which I think is good. And I think that holds true for – anytime something is open, whether it be the open practice back in April, whether it be the open practice on Monday, whether it be the three practices that we've seen 15 minutes of practice and exactly what we've seen in practice, because there was a little bit of a surprise that we were seeing some 11-on-11 stuff one day from the media members. But there's a reason they did it. There's a reason, you know, some of it's to give us a better gauge of where they're at, but some of it is to kind of say, this is, you know, we're putting the number one offense here against the 3s and 4s on defense. And, you know, you do see that. So you also have to be keenly aware of when you have the eye test, what exactly are you watching against what with these?
The last thing I want to say on the quarterbacks thing is, you know, if you look at Monday's scrimmage, and there were three to me, like three really impressive throws, right, and catches. There are the two deep balls from Russo to Naylor and Reed. And then there's the ball that that Thorne threw over the head of the defender 25 yards downfield on a dime to a leaping Reed who makes a great catch, but it's a great throw. That
good
to me is the harder, more – that's the more impressive throw. Like the deep balls, lots of guys can throw a deep ball. And don't get me wrong, they were good deep balls, but we've seen that. Like, to me, the 25-yard throw against coverage and also what frustrated Tucker so much last year was that they couldn't convert third and fours. They couldn't get that 7-yard throw on those sort of plays. It just killed drive after drive. The underneath stuff was really Rocky Lombardi's downfall. And, again, Peyton Thorne at certain points wasn't up to the snuff either. Otherwise, you don't bring in Anthony Russo. They didn't think they had – or maybe they would have brought in a transfer anyway because they need somebody to compete with. But I am also curious. What we have not seen a lot of is who's making – the throws in those key situations and scrimmages and practices when they're doing third downs, who's making the 7-yard out and getting it there, the throw that you have to make as a quarterback to keep an offense going.
Well, you say about the third and four, they couldn't make third and one, third and two, fourth right. and one, fourth and two. That was a big problem all the way around, not just the quarterback. I mean, I think that goes into play with the running back battle as well, and the offensive line. I mean, you've got to be able to get those short yardage situations so you aren't third and four or third and seven, right? I mean, you know, they have struggled on offense to convert, and you know, it's been 3 years now of since they had a serviceable running game, and it's been dwindling since. So I mean, that's a priority with the because we focus and fixate so much on the quarterback situation that, you know, you look at the running back battle, and I'm equally unclear with that because they've shuffled guys around. I mean, I would imagine that Kenneth Walker seems to be the guy who's got the most complete abilities from what we saw in the spring and a little bit this fall, but then we see him working with the third unit, right? So I mean, that's, you know, and then Elijah Collins working with the ones, and you know, Jordan Simmons bouncing around, and Harold Joyner and Donovan Eaglin, and moving Connor Hayward to tight end. I mean, you know, there's a lot of shell games, I think, going on with this that, you know, to me, I think is brilliant strategically, because you don't want to give Pat Fitzgerald an idea of what your actual depth chart is. I mean, when you have so many different guys, you want to try and mix them and move them around. So if you have something open to us, as I was saying, with the intent factor, the video gets out from that, and you don't know who is the number one defense. You don't know who the number one running back is. So, you know, I think that's to me been, you know, an interesting facet of Tucker's regime so far. I think that they did a pretty good job of what was open, mixing things up to keep things looking muddled. But listen, coaches know by now who's going to be the guy up at the one, particularly this close to a game. And if they've already started and turned their prep toward Northwestern this week with a full prep week next week, I think they have a pretty good idea, and we'll probably find out soon.
It would be wild to see. And I kind of want to see Mel Tucker do this. Just put Connor Hayward in running back for the first play of the game and just really kind of mess with everybody's mind there. That's the alpha move.
Put Connor Hayward at Wildcat as the starting quarterback.
Yes. You beat me, Chris. Even better
idea. You're welcome. I've blown Jay Johnson's big surprise.
I think you want Hayward. If you want Hayward on a jet sweep, just to have people, their minds.
Oh, no, Wildcat to the jet sweep.
To the short
direct snap.
To the short
and
side.
Then a jet sweep. I mean, that is the ultimate troll job for Michigan State fans right there.
And then third and one up the middle, four straight times.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen that much of Kenneth Walker, but man, that dude is he looks good in the photos. That's good. That's good enough for me at this point, considering what we've seen from the Michigan State running backs the past few years.
Yeah, and I mean, they've got a variety of different styles, I think, too. I mean, you know, a lot of what we've seen with Harold Joyner in the limited glimpses we've seen They've used him in the out of the backfield in the passing game. He's got good hands. He's got tremendous size at 6'4" for a running back. I mean, you don't and he said, I believe both Scarborough and Derrick Henry are guys that he looked to emulate because, I mean, how many other guys do you have that are 6'4"? You know, what was Eric Dickerson, like 6'3"? I mean, it's a rarity to see a running back that big. But, you know, I think that, Collins is going to be an interesting wild card health-wise. I mean, he showed the talent to run for nearly 1,000 yards in the Big Ten behind a banged-up offensive line that I think we need to keep in mind. So he's got talent. And, you know, then, you know, Simmons last year showed flashes. But I think also – you know, the one thing to keep in mind about Simmons is that he didn't redshirt last year, so he's still got that. He's still got 5 years if he wanted to. He could take a redshirt this year, and you know that I don't think that would count against his eligibility clock because of the way the COVID year is, he'll get the extra year anyway. So that said, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of running backs there too, so it's
Yeah, and I like Simmons a lot, as you brought up. I think he's the best at putting his foot in the ground and going in some ways. And I think that, you know, Walker has just looked like a different level dude.
Yeah.
And Collins part of the mix. I do think that, you know, I do think it's those three that you're going to see the most of. And I think you'll see planned carries for all three in the opener. And they'll let it sort of unfold. And really the question for me will become, you know, in 2015, you remember when L.J. Scott was their finishing back? Like, that's how you knew they had Madre London and Gerald Holmes, but you knew who their best back was because in the fourth quarter when they had to salt away games, that was the dude who was in. So that's who I'm kind of looking forward to seeing, too. Who do they have in games? Yeah. And Northwestern is probably going to be a game that's close enough that we'll see where they're who they trust most and who they think can get the job done at the end.
And I think, you know, going back to the quarterback situation, to flip the other side, that pass from Thorne to Jaden Reed, I thought Chester Kimbrough was in good coverage. So that's still a situation that I think is fluid on the corner. And they're gonna, and that's a different situation than the other spots because when you play a 4-2-5 or if you're going to play some dime coverage, you're going to need a lot of guys to play, you know, a lot of defensive backs to play in varied roles. So, I mean, you know, you've got – and I thought Kalen Gervin got burned on one of those deep Russo passes. So, you know, Charles Brantley was running with the first unit at cornerback. And, you know, I think that Ronald Williams adds a factor. So, I mean, I'm not – I think the competition for playing time is interesting at corner and in safety but and in the nickel spot. But I also – don't think it's a thing that matters all that much because they're going to play a lot of guys because of the way their defense is constructed. The linebacker spot, though, that's really interesting because they were certainly shuffling guys around. I mean, your number one linebackers were Cal Halliday and Quaveris Crouch, and Noah Harvey was repping with the third unit, a returning starter. So what does that mean? I mean, I guess we'll see in 8 days at Northwestern.
Yeah, does that
8.5 days, seeing as how late it is.
Does that mean Harvey is serving like an unspecified team? He broke some unspecified team rule and he might be out for the first game, or has he been bumped off the depth chart by those two guys? I mean, I know that's what I'm saying. It could be anything. I loved Halliday coming out of high school, so I'm excited to see to apparently see him in the mix there at linebacker. Is there any other positions or Michigan State football talk do you guys kind of want to cover? We'll kind of go more in depth for each position next year. But if you guys got any takes,
we're not waiting a year.
Next year. I'm just so excited. A year, week, months, whatever. Do you guys have anything else you wanted to kind of get out there?
No, I think this is a good broad look at things, and hopefully by, you know, as we start to preview Northwestern and look at things, we'll have some answers at quarterback. You know, I mean, I think it's a fascinating team that. We really don't know what they're going to look like, but I think they have a chance. At least they're starting 22. I mean, there's depth a few places. We know there's depth at running back. Obviously, quarterback, there may not be much difference. But I think their starting 22 has a chance to be pretty good. In some years, you can stay healthy enough that's okay. And other years, you can't. And so, like, this is one of those teams that I do wonder in certain places – how much the drop off in depth would really affect. But early on, I think, you know, I think they if they're healthy, they ought to be a competitive side. And I, you know, and we'll talk about the Northwestern game next week, but I don't buy Northwestern as a favorite, and frankly, neither do the bettors, because the line has moved from 6 to like 3, basically. It's practically a home, it's practically a neutral site game against a team with a lot of offensive questions and a team whose talent level is never actually that much better than MSU. We saw MSU beat them last year, and so it should be a telling first week, but you know, so I certainly think Michigan State has a good chance.
Well, and I think the other thing, kind of big picture with this, you know, it is a year, like you said, that we don't know what to expect from this team because there are so many new pieces. But I think the larger scope is there are going to be a lot of people watching this nationally. A lot of coaches, a lot of personnel people within football buildings are going to be watching this, because this is going to be, I mean, with the transfer portal being wide open with immediate eligibility, this will be used as a test case. Can this be done at this high, this broad a scope, to have essentially, you know, nearly a half roster turned over? Is it, I mean, if it doesn't work, you'll see teams shy away from it. If it does work, I think this will become a lot more of the norm in college football. And I mean, we're basically on our way to free agency. So there's going to be a lot of eyes on Michigan State, one way or another within the industry. You know, and it'll be interesting to see if they do start generating a buzz and winning some games and surpassing those expectations, how quickly other programs start to say, you know what, we're going to take that model and broom some guys and bring a lot of guys in to have a reset.
All right. Well, that feels like a great place to wrap things up for today. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, Chris Solar, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Green White. Thanks for listening.